for trying to betray me again. "Is that his shirt?" Ajita asked. I nodded. Ajita had dropped her skirt and was working her shorts up over her hips, over her two white underpants that came all the way up to her waist, the way mine did. She was the only person I knew who wasn't fire and brimstone and still wore underpants that came all the way up to her waist. The year before, when I'd dressed out, I'd always pulled my shorts up before I took my dress off. "Are you going to do gym today?" "No," I told her. "Mr. Groves, he won't let me wear it in there." I held on to the tail of James's shirt and stood there. "Can you leave it in your locker for just a little while?" she coaxed. I shook my head and walked away. I knew I would fail gym. Nothing concerned me less. I spent the hour sitting in the bleachers with a heavy girl who didn't want to take off her clothes for other reasons. I watched Ajita doing her stretches, her jumping jacks, her sit-ups. I watched the class break into teams and then begin a game of volleyball, the teams rotating so that everybody got to serve. I wanted to serve. I could have hit that ball so hard it went through the basketball goal at the far end of the gym. I didn't think about anything important, sitting there, just the stale air and the hardness of the bleachers beneath me, like a church pew. When it was Ajita's turn, she held the ball in her left hand, smacked it with her right fist, and sent it soaring over the net, where somebody else missed, and she got to serve again. If I could have held that ball, I would have put it under my shirt, James's shirt, to see what it would feel like to carry something beneath my clothes, besides nettles. It wasn't long before I knew. Nights, I'd lay flat on my back, wearing just my thin nightgown and James's shirt. I'd lift my neck and peek down to the place where the bones of my pelvis reared up, and I'd look at the place between them, where nothing had ever been but flatness, like the plains, and I could see the beginning of a mountain. But it wasn't a mountain. It was hardly even a hill. My clothes still fit in the mornings, but by afternoon, I could tell that they were getting too tight. I tried not to think about James. I figured if everybody else could pretend he'd never existed until the pain let go, I should be able to do that too. I'd never been able to sleep on my back. I'd always slept on my stomach, like a normal person. But I couldn't do that anymore. Not with the breasts that grew and grew and ached with it. I wanted to talk with Nana, but I could never get her alone. After school in the pack house, I untied tobacco with the other women, ripping away the string, tossing the cured leaves onto burlap sheets, and hurling the sticks onto the pile to be collected and used again. Even the smell of tobacco, the smell I loved, made me sick, and every motion of my arms irritated my sore chest. I wanted to talk with Ajita Patel, but then I remembered her little girl underpants and knew that I couldn't. There was nobody to talk to, nowhere, without James around. But Corinthian Lovell was in my classes that year. She'd failed again. I couldn't figure out why she hadn't dropped out of school. She had to be almost 17, and she couldn't have been learning much because she only showed up half the time. She sat at the back during home economics. I decided one day to talk to her. Not to tell her about me or James, but to find out about Ben Harback, to ask if she'd seen him. Or at least, that's what I told myself I was doing. We were on the sewing machines that day. Corinthian, who hadn't brought in a project to work on, was sitting at the back filing her nails, waiting for the bell to ring so she could leave. I folded up the big skirt I was making before it was time and told the teacher I needed to use the restroom. Corinthian didn't look at me at all. She never looked at me. But that day, needing somebody to talk to more than ever, I stood in the doorway, whispered, "Corinthian," and motioned her to come out. She picked up her books unapologetically, waved goodbye to the teacher, and followed me through the door. "What?" she said disdainfully. ask you something. Well? I knew there was no time for small talk, so I just blurted out. I think I'm having a baby, and I don't know what to do.
What?
She shrieked.
You?
I looked at the floor.
Well, goddamn, Nina. That's your name, isn't it?
I nodded.
Well, shit, she said. We can't talk about it here. Come on.
Where are we going? I asked her. But I was already behind, and she led me out the side door, out into the bus parking lot. She kept looking back at me, breaking into a shocked laugh that made her dimples sink.
Didn't your boyfriend die?
She asked loudly.
I mean, I'm sorry about it and all, but isn't he dead?
Yeah, I said, and bit my lip.
Well, is it his? Was it his?
I guess so, I muttered.
You guess so? Holy shit, do your parents know?
No, I said, and they're gonna kill me, if it's true.
God damn, I guess they might kill you for that at Fire and Brimstone.
I hadn't meant it. I'd never really thought they might kill me until she said it that way.
Have you taken the test?
She asked.
What test?
The pregnancy test, dope, she chided, then added, I'm sorry. Because I was crying, and then, it's okay. Because I was on her shoulder when she probably didn't even expect it.
She smelled like perfume, sprayed on hard, and I thought she must have squirted it all in one place for it to be so strong.
It made me feel like I might throw up, so I backed away.
Do you have any money?
Corinthian asked me.
Uh-uh, I said. That's okay. We'll figure something out. Come on.
I followed her out to the highway, looking back every few seconds to see if any teachers were chasing us. But I guess they had better things to do. Up ahead, Corinthian was calling out to the air,
Wee Jesus!
And laughing like I was the biggest joke she'd ever heard.
You ever cut school before?
She yelled back.
No,
I said.
Wee Jesus!
She said again. We didn't have to wait long before a man in a pickup stopped. The first couple of cars had driven by, so Corinthian had yanked the elastic out of the bottom of my braid and undone it. All that hair flying loose beside the highway. It was a strange feeling, and pretty soon I was laughing a little too.
Take us to Kmart, please, Corinthian said to the driver, if you're going that far.
He smirked and drove along quietly, which was probably a good thing. Right before he let us out, he said, You gals want to smoke some? But Corinthian told him we didn't have time, and thanked him. She knew just where to go in the store. It was so big, with so many things for buying, and I didn't want her to know I'd never been there before.
I don't have any money, I reminded her. You don't need any, she said. Come on.
And she picked up a pregnancy test off the shelf, plucked it away from so many others just like it, and she led me straight into the bathroom where she locked the door.
You just have to pee on that little stick, she said.
But I'd never even peed in front of another person before, except maybe Pammy at the edge of a tobacco row when nobody else was looking. And even then, Pammy looked away. Corinthian Lovell stared right at me.
Go ahead, she said. Pee on it.
But I couldn't.
Oh, Jesus, she moaned. You're one of those shy bladder people, ain't you? Just bite your little fingernail. It'll come.
So I did it, blushing, trying not to pee on my hand, but doing it anyway.
Now we'll just leave this little plastic thing in here beside the commode and pretend to shop. We'll come back and check it in 15 minutes.
But we didn't have to wait. Before I'd even finished washing my hands, the little sign was turning red.
Oh, girl, she said. You're pregnant, all right.
I couldn't figure out what I was doing in there with her, in the bathroom of Kmart with a stolen pregnancy test. I already knew I was having a baby. I'd known for 2 months. Since the day that James died, Olin hadn't been the same. Bethany couldn't let the morning hold her down too long, because she had Pammy and Mustard to take care of. But Olin kept sinking deeper and deeper. He wouldn't go into the church after James's funeral. Grandpa Herman said prayers out loud for him, saying he'd slipped into the quicksand of despair, the quagmire of doubts. I knew that it worried Grandpa Herman for one of his strongest supporters to stop attending church. I couldn't figure out why Grandpa was so understanding, and then I remembered he'd lost a son himself. Grandpa kept saying that he hurt for Olin, but that he wouldn't find peace until he reached back out to Jesus. They talked a lot, Grandpa and Olin, but even Grandpa's presence wasn't enough to penetrate whatever Olin was walking through. It must have been the thorns. I secretly thought that Olin must be lamenting the way he'd turned James's bed into a briar patch that time he'd soiled it. I wondered what his bed looked like. Church was totally different without James or Olin or even Ben Harback. Nobody received the gift of tongues. Mama still held her hands up to God, but I could tell by the way she walked, slow, like an old lady down the church steps, that he hadn't filled them with his love. I was almost sure that the rapture had come and gone, and with it, God's love had exited fire and brimstone for good. It seemed so ironic to me that our tight-knit community, where everybody ate together and prayed together and slept so close we might as well have been in the same bed, hurt so independently. It was the one thing we couldn't do as a group. Everybody felt it differently, and nobody talked. Except Nana. "How long you planning on keeping that secret under your shirt?" she said to me one day while we were canning the last of the tomatoes. It was nearly time for the frost. Wanda and Laura had taken the rest of the mason jars into the kitchen to wash, but I was outside with Nana, cooking down the red paste. I didn't even answer her. "I've been thinking a lot about it, baby, and I swear to you, I don't know what will happen when your blind mama finds out, or Herman, either one. Liston shouldn't be so much of a problem, but your mama, Lord, child." "How did you know?" I whispered. "I've known for a time. I've been waiting for you to tell me, but you're getting as tight-lipped as the rest of them." "Nana," I said, "it's not what you think."
"No," Nana said. "What you reckon it is, then? You swallowed a watermelon seed?"
I knew what I should be feeling was tears. The same tears I'd been coughing down for nearly 3 months. And the guilt of breaking the law and letting everybody down and causing James to take his own life. But all I wanted to do was laugh. Not the happy kind of laughing. The kind that comes out sounding like thunder or a shotgun blast, breaking the day with a big ear-crunching kind of jolt. Right out loud, I said, "It's Jesus's baby. I'm having Jesus's baby." And then I turned to Laura and Wanda, who were standing on the doorsteps with their mouths dropped open, clean jars in their hands, and I said, "I'm having the child of God." I don't know what they took me in the church for. I guess they thought I wouldn't lie if I was in the church, but they had it all wrong. I didn't set out to lie or anything, but by that time, it didn't matter where I was, church or no church. Truth and lies all looked the same to me by then. It didn't matter where they took me. There was no telling what would come out of my mouth. Everybody but Olin was there, though. Grandpa Herman held me by the arm up at the front, while the entire community filled in the first few rows of seats. Everybody sat so close, shoulder to shoulder, with Pammy between Bethany and Wanda, and Mustard between Wanda and Everett, and Nana between Everett and Mama, and so on. From the front where I stood, it looked like they were blocking me in, like they were using their bodies to keep me from running away. Grandpa Herman didn't bother with the fornication sermon. He jumped right in with the questions.
"Does your condition have anything to do with James's untimely death?" he asked me.
Mama wailed out so loudly that Grandpa said, "Marie, honey,
We need to be able to hear the girl's answer.
No, I said.
What'd you say?
He scolded. No, sir, I corrected.
Was James the father of this baby growing in your womb?
Grandpa's thumb was trying to break my arm. No, sir.
Are you telling me that you and James were not guilty of fornication?
He bellowed. And I knew that no matter what I said, he wouldn't believe me. I could see Daddy doubled over, his head on his own knees. Nana kept her gaze straight ahead, but she didn't look like she was listening. David and Laura both looked into their laps while Everett watched Grandpa and Wanda watched me. But poor Pammy was the one I was worried about most. She had her head buried in Bethany's jacket. Mama kept crying and snuffling, but she looked like she had a candle in her head, burning, and I could see it flickering wild behind her eyes. No, sir, I answered. Me and James never fornicated.
Well, who in God's name have you fornicated with, Nina?
I thought it must have been Jesus giving me courage, because I had enough courage for two people, or maybe three. I've never fornicated with nobody, I claimed.
And I reckon you're going to tell us next that you ain't with child either,
Grandpa Herman proposed. As he talked, he ground his hand harder into my arm. I'm with child, I said. It's Jesus's baby.
Blasphemy! He shouted,
and he slapped me down.
In the Lord's own house!
Pammy screamed and didn't stop. I was on the floor, and at first all I could see were the boards, little brown rectangles fitting neatly into each other. I thought I'd like to be just one little wooden rectangle fitted so neatly into the floor. Then Daddy was there, offering me his hand, helping me up, and I could hear Mama wailing out, joined by Wanda, I think. There was blood on my face, maybe from my nose, I wasn't sure.
Sit down, Liston, Grandpa said. You will not strike my child again, Daddy spewed. No leader threatens his people that way.
I looked down, dizzy. Drops of blood fell between pauses, splatting one wooden rectangle of floor. I watched a drop trickle along the board's outline, wishing I could pour myself into the spaces between boards.
Everett, Grandpa Herman said, get your daddy, son.
And Everett staggered over to where Daddy was standing beside me. Come on, Daddy, Everett tried, and he put his hand on Daddy's shoulder, but Daddy shook it off.
She has to be punished, Liston,
Grandpa Herman shouted.
The girl is standing up here pregnant, telling us that this unborn child belongs to Jesus.
I will not leave her, Daddy said. I ain't opposed to punishments, but I am opposed to violence. Nina ain't safe up here without me, and I ain't sitting down. Then Mustard jumped up and said, I ain't sitting down either. But before he could get to the front of the church, Everett had caught him and held him off. No! Mustard cried, tossing his head like a caged-up horse. No! And I thought he was going wild, punching at Everett like it was his fault. I looked to Nana, trying to will her to do something, but only her body was there. Her eyes were gone far away. Back to Virginia, I thought. Back to the house where her daddy died.
Tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., Grandpa Herman said, Nina Huff will be dunked for blasphemy. Tonight, there will be no supper.
Daddy held me close to him, walking me back to the house. Mama didn't come with us. I don't know where she went. When we got to the house, Olin was there, standing on the doorsteps. He didn't say a thing, but he held the door and kissed me on the head before I went inside. I guess all the madness made me stubborn. It might have dazed my thinking a little bit, too, because I didn't even notice that there was dried blood on my face until much later when I was sitting in bed and some flecks scabbed onto my blanket. I figured Grandpa Herman was planning on starving me to death. That'd be one way of getting rid of a baby. If I died from not eating before the baby was born, then the baby'd die too, and everything would be settled. And if that didn't work, maybe he was counting on me catching pneumonia from being dunked and dying that way. Either way, he was planning on killing me. But I knew I wouldn't die. I prayed that night. I told God I knew that the child was his, and that if he was planning on seeing it grow up and make something of its life, he'd better help me out. I read in the Bible about Mary and wished there was more to know. I knew my baby would be born with an invisible ring on its finger, one like I'd given to James. I knew he'd be a special leader for us, one strong enough to tear down fire and brimstone and start again, even if nobody could see the ring. And I fell asleep the way I reckon people fall in love, without even knowing it's happening. Early that next morning, I woke to the sound of bells ringing. At first they were far away, and then they were right in my ear. Mama standing there, dressed all in black and ringing a bell so close that the sound seeped into my pillow and clanged under my neck. Bethany on the other side of the bed, dressed in gray, moved her wrist like a machine so that the bell hit opposite Mama's, uneven and terrible instead of beautiful, the way a bell should be. "Hey," I said, not remembering at first what they were there for. But then Grandpa Herman yelled, "Silence!" And I jumped, because I hadn't known he was in the room. The bells kept ringing as I stood up and then followed them out, still wearing my nightgown with James's shirt over it, not even putting on my shoes. Outside, everybody was waiting. We formed a ridiculous parade, walking down the dirt road, that sand so cold on my feet. Mama and Bethany kept ringing the bells, walking beside me. Grandpa Herman led the way, and behind us, everybody except Olin shuffled along. It was like walking through a dream. I wasn't sure if Daddy was there, and I didn't think I was supposed to look behind me, but I did it anyway, and saw him with Everett and David. Pammy tried hard to catch my eye, but I wouldn't look at her, and only saw her tiny wave after it was too late to wave back. Grandpa Herman didn't slow down, even when he came to the woods. But the straw and sticks and briars hurt my feet. Because I couldn't keep up, he had to shorten his strides. It wasn't raining just then, but it looked like it might at any minute. I couldn't tell if the dreary sky came from the weather or the earliness. I kept looking at the clouds, waiting for God to rapture me, thinking that maybe I'd had it wrong all along. Maybe I'd be the only one called home when the angel sounded his trumpet. Maybe they'd be left to perish, and I'd live it up in heaven with Jesus and James and my baby. In case I was right, I prayed quietly that God would take Daddy, too, and Pammy and Mustard and Nana. And maybe Mama and Wanda and the rest of them, but I wasn't sure if I wanted them all up there with me. That'd make heaven a lot like fire and brimstone, and that just didn't seem all that heavenly. We walked for a long, long time, right along the creek until it widened out at the far end of the property into the pond where James had died. And I knew then that I was being punished for more than blasphemy, but I couldn't let myself think about James, not just then. I thought instead about alligators. I knew there were alligators because I'd seen them once before, when we were baptizing Wanda. I decided maybe Grandpa Herman was planning on killing me by dunking me in the water right where the mother alligator had her babies. Because, unlike my own mama, I was almost sure that a mother alligator would raise holy hell when somebody messed with her young. The bells got louder and louder in my head, even though it felt like everybody was far away from me, like they couldn't touch me if they wanted to. I told myself it'd be like a baptism. Mercifully, we didn't go to the part of the pond where James had tied his rope and walked out. That would have been too much for Mustard and Pammy and Bethany. We filed along the opposite bank, around dying cattails and withering huckleberry bushes. There was a big upright tree on that side of the pond, with limbs thick as washtubs, and somebody had built a stand into it. I'd never noticed the stand before, and tried to figure if it was put there for men to sit in while hunting for deer, or if it had been used before for dunkings. The thick plank stretched between two giant limbs that leaned way out over the water. I'd never seen a dunking in my lifetime. I wasn't even sure what a dunking was. As I was climbing up the tree's makeshift ladder, with David in front of me and Everett following behind, I tried to recall if I'd seen Nana in the procession. I couldn't remember seeing her. I scraped my knees against the bark, reaching high for each wooden slat and pulling myself up, wondering if Everett was looking up my nightgown, if he could help it. When I got to the top, I followed David out on a limb. I had to straddle it and scoot myself along, and the bark rubbed hard at the inside of my thighs, rubbed the skin off of me, it seemed. I was glad to have James's shirt. The day was chilly and damp, and so strange. I pretended that the shirt was James, wrapped around me all the way, and I pretended that I wasn't alone, even though I knew better. When I had crawled onto the flimsy board, way up above the water, I looked down at the people behind me, their faces so unfamiliar it was like they were somebody else's family. They were all watching Grandpa Herman tying a tiny wire cage onto the heavy rope that Everett held from the top of the tree ladder, and even though I knew it wasn't the rope once tied to James, I couldn't help thinking of it, the way it smelled wet, like an old rug left out in rain. I could feel the board sag beneath me, not like it was going to give, but like it was thinking about it. I thought maybe I should jump before they had a chance to do whatever they had planned. I wondered if I'd hit bottom, if I jumped, if I'd break my bones and be in too many pieces to swim away. Too bad it wasn't the river. If they'd taken me to the river, I could have swam underwater until I was far from them. But in a pond, there was nowhere to go. Everett made his way along the limb, to the place where the plank bridged branches. David sat on the branch to my right, and Everett sat on the branch to my left, and I sat in the middle, my long, long legs dangling, and I stared down, stared out at the broken tree, and imagined its underwater arms waiting for something to grab. I stared far beyond the pond, where the land belonged to someone else. Everett slid the cage down the plank to me. Fortunately, the plank was sort of wide. "Toss that rope to David," he said. So I passed the rope along. David tied his end of the worn-out rope to his limb. Everett tied his end of the rope to his limb. And then they dropped the cage into the water to make certain that the rope was long enough. I reminded myself that the James rope was still coiled up on the floor of my bedroom closet, where I'd hidden it months earlier. When the cage hit the water, it didn't sink right away. It went down slowly as water passed through all the holes. It was made of the same wire we used to fence in the chicken coop, heavy wire with square holes almost as big as slices of bread. Then they grabbed the ropes and pulled the cage back up, all the way up to me, where it dripped on my nightgown and chilled my arms. "Pull it up on the plank," David instructed. "Now balance it, that's good. And open that little flap right there," he pointed, "and crawl in."
"Be careful," Everett said. "Don't fall." I shook like that spider suspended over the pits of hell by a thread, the one Grandpa Herman referred to in his sermons ever so often. "You gotta turn around," Everett told me. "You gotta back in so you can close the door." It's a miracle I didn't fall off. Not that it would have mattered. They'd have made me swim out and climb up to the plank again. But I didn't fall. I trembled as the plank beneath me swayed. But I turned around up there, on my hands and knees, and I backed into the cage, so small that I had to squench up like a rock. It was hard for me to find a place for my arm once I'd fastened the hook.
"Ready, boys?"
Grandpa Herman called.
"Yeah,"
one of them yelled. But I was so turned around that I wasn't sure if it was David or Everett. And maybe it was the fear, because I had plenty of that. Or maybe it was the feeling of being captured in the air, because capturing usually happens on the ground, when at least you've got the earth to support you. But for whatever reason, everything around me got loud. They were praying down there, voices that didn't sound like voices at all. It sounded like clapping and whistles and moans, and I couldn't tell what was happening because all I could see was the wire and the plank, my face pressed next to that damp wood. Then Grandpa Herman gave a sermon that I didn't hear like words. I heard it like rain and things blowing in wind, and then I realized that it was raining and the wind was real. And then I was dropping hard, and I kept my eyes open so I could see the water coming for me, getting closer and closer until it was nothing but a shining, and I fell faster than the cage so that my skin pressed against it, and there was a cold wire barrier like a cross cutting between my nose and my mouth, and I felt like each of my breasts had slipped through a different hole. When I hit, the water stunned me, not from the temperature, but from the hardness of it. I felt like I'd hit a table or a floor, not water. And I didn't even realize I was sinking or that my mouth was full until my ears bubbled. Before I knew I was under, I could feel myself pulled up, a foot at a time. My backside was in air before my face was. The praying continued as they raised me, bit by bit, and the water that had been on me dripped off, first like juice, then like seeds. I wondered if I was as heavy as I felt. I looked out at the fallen tree across the pond and remembered that people weigh more when they're wet. I wondered if David and Everett's arms would give out. But then I heard,
"Let her go!"
And I fell again. I tried to cover my face with my hands that time, but I couldn't make them let go of the cage, holding on to it like it was all they knew to grip. Then, underwater, I promised my lungs that I'd take in more air the next time. I let out a little air each time I felt them lifting me, but I couldn't tell how long it would be before I'd find air again. I couldn't tell how deep I was, and I didn't want to open my eyes. When I was out of the water that time, I managed to tilt my head so that I could look at the congregation, and though I was too far away to see expressions, I could tell that the man who was walking away was Daddy. I didn't care. It was Nana I wanted to see. And she was there. The third time before they dropped me, I sucked in so much air that it hurt. But I let it all out without meaning to when I spanked through the surface. I mouthed, "Heba Mashundi, Heba Mashundi," feeling the murkiness saturate my tongue. And that time when they pulled me out, I was coughing. I wondered if they'd stop if I repented. I wondered if I cried out or prayed aloud or begged, if that would be enough. But I didn't. Up in the air, the cage rocked and swung. I wondered if they'd stop if I vomited. Then in the water again, in the dirty water, I decided to breathe. Breathe like James, burst my lungs and be done with the whole damn thing. I'd breathe, "Heba Mashundi," one syllable at a time, and by the time I was through, I'd be in heaven. And I almost did it, too, except I opened my eyes for one last peek at the things we see alive, and I saw the bottom. It was brown and soft, and there were pieces of sticks and logs, and there were moving shadows in the distance, maybe of fish, though my splashing kept them from swimming nearby. I wondered if James had opened his eyes. There were things growing, even in autumn, even underwater. And as I got farther and farther away from them, as David and Everett heaved me up, it seemed like they were a miniature world, underwater, operating by different rules, knowing different things to be true, and thriving all the same. I decided I couldn't die. Not when I had a baby living in me, depending on me, a baby who could change things. I knew there was something inside me that could imagine a different world and make it so. Back in the air, suspended like a promise, I listened to them praying, hollering out, and I heard Grandpa Herman yell,
"Pull her up another 5 feet before you drop her again. She ain't getting much impact."
But then Nana said, "She's had enough." The praying stopped. Everything stopped, except the rain and the wind and my strong, strong heart.
"I said, pull her up another 5 feet,"
Grandpa hollered.
"And I said, that's enough,"
Nana spoke. I dallied over that pond for what seemed like a long time, crouched above the water, closer to heaven than Grandpa, with all my doubts draining out. And if the rapture had happened right then, if I had heard the trumpets, I knew that I'd have been the first one to get to Jesus, because David and Everett would be slowed down by the trees, but I'd lift right off, and plus, I wasn't as heavy as either of them, though I carried 2 souls. Nana put me to bed, and I slept. But I wasn't so brave in my dreams. They kept making me cry. First I dreamed I had barbed wire in my chest, coiled around my ribs, and for some reason my heart was growing bigger and bigger, and my heart couldn't see the barbs waiting there to pierce it. I tried to find someone to unravel the wire and take it out, but everybody I told kept saying, "It's there to keep your heart from swelling up so much. Your heart will see it in time and shrink back down." Then I dreamed I was dead, but walking around. I kept begging James to bury me, but he'd say, "You ain't dead. Look, you're walking around." But my skin was already falling off. Every step was a mile, and nobody would bury me. Then I dreamed I had the baby, and it was crying, and I couldn't make it stop. I tried to feed it, but it wouldn't eat. I shoveled spoonful after spoonful of food into its mouth, but it kept spitting all over the church, covering the pews and the altar and the pulpit with strained vegetables. Finally, I started laughing. There was baby food everywhere. And then the baby started laughing too, hard and like an old, old man, coughing in his laughing, and he said, "It's a joke on you. I'm 90 years old, and I'm not your baby." Then I dreamed I walked to my bedroom door, opened it, and found Mama and Daddy in my bed, being carnal. There were candles all over the room, and I could see that there were peppers in the bed with them, all around them, hot peppers, red and green and all over the mattress. But they didn't know that there was another bed up above them, at a 45-degree angle from the headboard, and it was about to drop down. "Daddy," I called, but he said, "Nina, get out of here." I wanted to tell him about the other bed, threatening to drop and crush them there on my sheets. I wanted to tell him that on top of that other bed, Grandpa Herman stood with his Bible, preaching crazy about the wages of sin and fornication. They couldn't hear him, but I could see him there in his brown suit, holding up his Bible, his other hand over his heart, and Mama and Daddy holding each other and moving on all those hot peppers without knowing. "Mama," I cried. "Close the door," she said. And then I was sitting on the doorsteps, crying because Mama and Daddy were about to die in my bed, and it started snowing. I didn't have on any shoes, so I tried to get up to go inside, but the door was locked. It was autumn, and not cold enough to snow, but the snow was falling everywhere, surprisingly, and I didn't have on any shoes. So I sat on the doorsteps, and the snow fell over my feet, and I cried because my feet hurt so much. Then my arms got so long I could bang on the door, banging and banging, hoping Mama and Daddy would hear. But when the door opened, the 90-year-old baby was there, and he said in his gravelly voice, "What do you want?" and then I was standing up and he let me inside. My feet were as red as Grandpa Herman's face, and the baby said,
"Did you boil your feet?"
"No," I said. "They got stuck in the snow." And the 90-year-old baby, who wasn't mine, said,
"No, you dangled them in the pits of hell. Your feet are burned. There's no snow here."
I woke up at Nana's house, and I didn't leave. The spare bedroom and a sitting room were separated from the rest of the house by a swinging door, and that front part of the house became my home. I was left in Grandpa Herman's care, so he could witness to me and read the Bible and try to win me back into Christ's fold. The whole time my stomach grew, I stayed at Nana's, making baby clothes and sleeping. I didn't eat with everyone else. And I wasn't allowed in the church until the baby was born and dedicated to Christ, and until I repented. I only went into the other part of the house to use the bathroom, and even then I didn't go when Grandpa Herman was home. Even though I had to pee all the time, I held it, or else I did it in a basin and poured it out the window. I never went to the bathroom when Grandpa Herman was around. Mama never came to see me, though sometimes I'd hear her in the next room, talking to Nana, asking about me and speaking so loudly that I knew she wanted me to hear. She must have been yelling.
"How's Nina?"
she'd say.
"Doing good," Nana'd answer. "I'm sure she'd like to see you."
"I don't want to upset her,"
Mama'd answer.
"It's too soon."
I found bags and bags of leftover fabric in the closet in the spare bedroom. Nana went through it with me and said she'd forgot about most of it and that I could make some baby clothes if I wanted. She helped me drag out an old sewing machine that worked just fine once we got the bobbin replaced, and I went to work, cutting out little gowns and blankets and Indian-style pants. Daddy came to see me almost every day. He never knew what to say, and so he'd talk about the weather.
"It's been cloudy."
"Yes, sir," I'd answer.
"We need the rain."
Sometimes he'd tell me about how Barley had the sweets for Melanie Evans, a younger cousin from the far side of the compound. Or he'd tell me about how Mama had put on his old trousers while she was painting my bedroom because she didn't want paint to spill on her good dresses. Mama wouldn't wear trousers.
"That's what I thought, too," he said. "But she did. Don't tell your grandpa."
I worked at that sewing machine until my eyes got bad, worked late into the nights whenever I couldn't sleep. At first my seams weren't so neat, but they got better and better. I didn't know if it'd be a boy baby or a girl baby, so I made clothes for both. I averaged 2 or 3 little outfits a day, only regretting that we didn't wear bright colors, because even if the rest of us wore browns and deep greens, baby should get to wear red and orange and yellow if they felt like it. Pammy and Mustard and Barley would sit at Nana's kitchen table and tell her about their grades at school. From the distant wall, I'd listen, though it was always hard to hear Pammy, since she said everything as if it were a secret.
"I got an A in gym class," she told Nana.
"Well, that's great," Nana praised.
"I can do more sit-ups in 1 minute than anybody else in my class."
"You're a strong girl."
"Can I have an orange?"
"Go ahead," Nana would say.
"Can I talk to Nina?"
"You know your great-grandpa don't allow that."
"But he's in the woods,"
Pammy'd argue.
"Can I?"
"I won't be the one to stop you."
Then Pammy would walk over to the swinging door and say,
"Nina, are you there?"
"Yeah," I'd answer.
"Thank you for that skirt you made me with the little shorts inside,"
she'd compliment.
"I'm glad you like it. If you'll let Nana wash it, your mama won't never know about the shorts."
"I'll wash it in the bathtub," she said. "Barley's got a crush on Melanie."
"That's what Daddy tells me," I'd answer. Because really, there was no real news at Fire and Brimstone. The whole time I talked to her, I dressed my head against the door, not hard enough to make it push towards her, but just lightly, hoping that Pammy's head was doing the same thing on the other side. "Corinthian says to tell you hey."
"Really?"
"Yeah. She asked about you on the bus."
"That's nice."
"She wanted to know how big your belly'd grew, but I told her hardly nobody was allowed to see you, and she rolled her eyes."
"That's just how Corinthian is," I laughed.
"Oh, and Mustard's quit going to church."
"What?"
"He says if Daddy don't have to go, he don't have to go either."
"Bethany don't make him?"
"She tried, but Daddy said that Mustard could stay home with him. And last Sunday, they went out to check the traps while everybody else was in preaching."
"Bet Grandpa Herman's mad.
He's about decided they're heathens. Mama cries about it all the time. She goes over to Granny Marie's, to your house, and they pray for a miracle for the community. Hey, Pammy, will you look in your storage closet and see if you can find any material you all don't need? 'Cause I'm making baby clothes."
"Okay."
I heard her getting up. "And Pammy, if I write a letter, will you deliver it to somebody at school?"
"Yeah,"
she said. "Come back next week," I told her, thinking by then I'd know the right thing to say to Ajita Patel, who I missed more than anybody. Almost. Grandpa Herman would come into the sitting room with me, but we didn't talk about anything but God. He wasn't rude or brutal or anything, but every time he'd begin with the same question.
"Are you prepared to admit to fornication?"
"No, sir."
"Well, let's go over the Apostle Paul."
And then he'd begin Bible study with me, patiently, as if he knew that I'd come back sooner or later, come back to fire and brimstone in my heart.
"Let us pray,"
he'd say, and I'd bow my head.
"Heavenly Father, we ask that you help Nina to admit to her mistakes, to think about the scribes and Pharisees who condemned the prostitute, to think about the prostitute who admitted to her wicked ways, to think about Jesus, who condemned no repenting sinner. Lord, we ask you to help Nina admit to her mistakes so she will be open to Jesus's love instead of his condemnation."
But I didn't pray with him. I saved prayer for myself, for sacred times when I could be alone with God and my baby. All the time that I was growing and my baby was growing within me, all that time that I spent alone, I prayed that God would show himself to me, would come visit and help me strangle the lonely. He came to me in a thousand ways. Sometimes he came like a lamb for me to cuddle and nurse. Sometimes he sat on my bed and beat out hymns on the bottoms of my feet. Sometimes he rode in on the wind, his curly hair long and thick as mine, blown all over his head so that I was almost sure he was a woman, and he'd pull up my dress and put his mouth on my stomach and talk to the baby. Sometimes he came like a thief in the night. Sometimes he wore lipstick. Sometimes he sent James. "Tell me a story," I said to Nana. My sinuses were all stopped up, even though I didn't think I had a cold. It was afternoon, and my feet looked plump as unpicked squash. They never looked that way in the mornings.
"All right,"
Nana said.
"What story do you want this time?"
"Tell me about February, when the baby comes."
"It'll be a cold day," Nana started. "And you wake up hurting."
"Bad?" "Not at first." "Worse than period pains?" I asked nervously.
"That's how they'll start."
"Skip ahead," I directed. "Up to the point where it's born." I was sitting in a chair with my feet propped up, embroidering a rabbit on a little smock I'd made, and Nana was across the room hemming a sheet. She looked tired. Her face had begun to look like an old apple, soft and not shaped quite right. She stopped sewing, but didn't look up.
"What'll happen?"
I asked her again.
Honey, I just don't know. Who'll be there? I tried, and I switched to fishbone stitches, because I needed my stitches to be interlocking and secure. I don't know. You'll be with me, won't you? I reckon so, she said. Don't know where else I'd be. Will it get stuck in me, the way the mares did? No, baby, she said. It'll make its way out. Well, what will happen? Nina, I can't tell you that story because I just don't know how it will be. There was something sad about her that day. I was scared because she wasn't reassuring me, not hardly at all. And I was scared that if I didn't change the subject, she was going to leave me too. I'd been by myself so much. Will you tell me a different story? Maybe, she said, stopping to pick up another spool. If you'll thread this needle for me. I'll try to think of one for you. I can't hardly see in here. The light's bad. She hobbled over to where I was sitting, handed me the needle and thread, and then backed out of my way so I could get more light. The eye of a needle is like the gateway to heaven, Nana said. Hard to tell who's going to be on a straight enough path to get through it. But I knew that it took more than being on the straight path. You had to be stiff enough not to bend when you tried to pass through. You had to be careful not to slip to the left or the right and think you were going through the middle all the time. It took me 3 or 4 tries before I got that needle threaded, and then I tied it off good so that I wouldn't have to do it again for a while. Do you remember your dreams, Nana? Your pregnant ones? She smiled for a second before she spoke. Oh, yes. Before Harold was born, the son that died when Herman was in the war, I had a dream that somebody stole him right out of my belly. I thought I'd woke up with a flat stomach, and that I'd give birth during the night without waking up at all, and that somebody had been there to take him away. Then with Marie, or it might have been with Ernest, I dreamed that my baby didn't have a face. That's scary, I said. You don't sleep the same when you're with child. You have all kinds of dreams. You having many? Yes, ma'am, I said. And I was about to tell her some when she picked up on a story. I was pregnant with Harold before Herman went off to the war. We hadn't known it for too long when they called him away. And then he was up in Pennsylvania for a time in army training before they shipped him overseas. I decided I'd go up to see him one time before he left and talked Imogen into going with me. Uncle Ernie carried us all the way to the train in his wagon, and that was bumpy riding, as you might expect. Imogen rode up on the seat with Uncle Ernie, and I stretched out in the back because I was sick as a dog, having to lean my head over the side every now and again. Me nor Imogen, neither one, had ever ridden a train before. I remember it was one of the scariest things I'd ever seen, long and stretched out like a great big spine. Most of the cars were for carrying coal, I believe, not people. But we crawled on it and found some seats. Imogen was little for her age, about the size of Pammy, though she was probably 15 at the time. And she had to carry both our bags because it was all I could do to stand up. I was nauseated so. I imagine Nana and Great-Aunt Imogen as me and Pammy, seeing us on a train and wishing we could ride one, even though I knew it'd probably make me sick just then. But I'd have done it if James had been in the army, about to go overseas and waiting to see me. That train was rickety and noisy and swayed this way and that. Seemed like I could feel that baby in my belly, sloshing around. But after a while, I didn't feel so sick anymore. I reckon you can get used to anything if you put up with it for long enough. And she paused. The curtains I'd made for Nana's sitting room were heavy and kept out most of the light. Even though it was the middle of the afternoon, it felt later,
and I yawned. So me and Imogen talked for a while, and then she fell asleep, and I just looked out the window, watching all the trees and fields go by, thinking that surely, sooner or later, the land would get different, and we'd go over a mountain or something. But we didn't. Kept going over rivers, though. Once we got up into Virginia, we kept crossing over rivers with big rocks in them, and those rivers up north are a lot wider than the ones we got here. They stretch out so far you'd think they were the sea, except for all the rocks. Me and Imogen got tired of talking and working on our embroidery, which we'd taken along. There was a man who came around selling things, and Imogen bought a pack of playing cards from him. "No, she didn't," I laughed. We weren't allowed to play cards at Fire and Brimstone, or even touch them if children took them to school. Cards meant gambling, and that was one of the devil's favorite pastimes. We'd been taught all our lives that touching cards was a quick ticket to hell. "Oh, yes," Nana smiled. "Imogen bought us a deck of cards, and we opened them up just giggling. We weren't Fire and Brimstone yet. Nobody was. But the Baptists didn't allow cards neither, and young women especially weren't allowed to have them. It had been one of the biggest freedoms I'd ever known, touching them things. Of course, we didn't know how to play them, so we divided them up by colors and then by numbers, and we studied the pictures of the king and the queen and the jack, and I made up a story for Imogen about how we were going to London to meet them. I reckon I've sinned in a lot of ways," I teased Nana, "but I ain't never touched no playing cards." She laughed. "Well, when we got to Pennsylvania, it was a Friday, and Herman was at the station waiting for us, wearing his uniform and hat. He'd shaved his beard off, and I didn't hardly recognize him, but he didn't hardly recognize me either, with my belly so big. Before he'd left, I'd still wore my hair down, even though I was married, but after he went off, I started putting my hair up, so I looked different to him, too, with my belly big and my hair pinned. He said if it hadn't been for Imogen, he'd have walked right past me." "What'd you do there?" I asked her. "He got us a room in somebody's house, somebody who rented out rooms by the night, and we walked down the streets, all three of us holding hands, but I was in the middle, and Herman had a bag over his shoulder, and Imogen had a bag over hers. It was a big city, Philadelphia, I reckon, or something like that, and there were more people than I'd ever seen. Horses everywhere, and cars, too. We sat on a bench for a long time and watched the people and waved to the soldiers who came by. Seemed like everybody was out shopping, even though it weren't Saturday yet. And Pennsylvania had a different smell to it than anywhere else I'd been. Smelled like textiles." "You didn't tell Grandpa Herman about the playing cards, did you?" I asked. "Oh, child, that's all we did the whole weekend. We sat in that room, me and Herman and Imogen and one of Herman's friends. I forgot his name, but he was a young married man like Herman who was far from his home. And we played cards all weekend long. Herman had learned some games in the army. One of them was called Setback, I believe. And we gambled with pennies from the time we got there until we left. Of course, we gave everybody their pennies back when the game was over." My mouth was open by that time, imagining Grandpa Herman happily gambling. There weren't but one bed in that room, so me and Imogen slept in it. Herman slept on the floor with his friend. And the next morning, Herman woke up early and came and knelt beside the bed and put his hand on my belly, and the young'un moved for him. I remember looking at his face, so surprised and happy, and I could tell he wanted to holler out, but he didn't want to wake up Imogen. He held his hand there for a long time, waiting for it to happen again, and each time I'd get so tickled just watching him that I'd shake the bed a little and make Imogen roll over in her sleep. "It was one of the sweetest times I remember," Nana said, "'cause we couldn't even talk for fear of waking them up, so we had to do it with our mouths and our expressions and our hands. I put my hands on his face, at the place where his beard used to be, and I just stroked his face and hoped he knew what I was thinking. "How long did you stay?" I interrupted. I didn't want to hear what she was going to say next. It made me ache down low for something I wouldn't ever have. Not before the rapture, anyway. And I knew that if the rapture hadn't happened yet, it might be a long time coming. Oh, we had to leave the next day. Climbed right back on the train and went south. Herman got shipped out that very next week. But that's enough of a story for today. You done made me tired, Nana said. I got to get started on supper. After she left, I imagined riding on a train, moving fast through fields and woods and over big rivers with rocks. I imagined me and Pammy in Philadelphia, sitting on a bench and throwing peanuts at birds, even though I didn't know if they had peanuts or birds, either one, on the streets of Philadelphia. But when I imagined us there, James never showed up. We waited at the train for him. We waited in the rented room. We played cards while we waited, and he didn't come. I kept thinking of that train as Jesus's backbone, wondering if I could just crawl on it, where it would take me. I wished so hard. The tips of my fingers felt minced from so much sewing. At some point, I took the little outfits out of their stacks and spread them across the bed, all along the dresser top, then out in the sitting room on the backs of chairs. There were so many, all in different sizes. Some had taken whole days, and others had taken half an hour. Some had patchwork figures quilted on them, and some were plain, the way the family